Today by sort of asking a series of questions. What do these three men have in common? The first was an auto racer who set the world speed record in Daytona in 1914. The second was a pilot who recorded the highest number of victories in aerial combat against the Germans in World War I. The third was a special messenger from the president who survived a plane crash in the Pacific Ocean, spent more than 22 days on a raft, nearly dying before he was rescued. All of these men lived through very dangerous circumstances. They all displayed great courage under distress. It's a bit of a trick question. There's actually only one man. They're all three the same man, and that man was Eddie Rickenbacker. If you've ever read any of his story, it's a very interesting one. The courage is an indispensable quality that a leader must have. So today we're going to continue the series of sermons we began covering the five aspects of character, godly character, that was the theme at this year's United Youth Camps. And so today we'll cover the fourth part of that aspect of godly character, and that is courage. To begin with, let's have a definition of what the word courage means. Courage is simply the ability and the willingness to confront fear or pain, danger or uncertainty or intimidation. Again, courage is the ability and willingness to confront fear or pain, danger, uncertainty, or intimidation. And one of the interesting aspects of courage is that it has different attributes. For instance, there's physical courage and there's moral courage. Physical courage is doing something in the face of physical pain or hardship, a difficult time, something on a outward expression, if you will. Moral courage is the ability to act rightly in the face of opposition or discouragement or even shame or scandal. As an example of this, to make this more real for us, today we're going to look at the example of Esther. Esther's a very interesting story. As we begin in that book, we find that she was an orphan. We're not told why or how that circumstance came to be. She's a great example of God giving courage when it's most needed. She lived during the time of the Persian Empire, and this would have been around 486 BC or so, about 100 years after Babylon had taken Judah captive. So as the book of Daniel sort of spells these things out, Persia would have been the second great world-ruling empire. So in chapter 1, we have the story sort of set. We're introduced to the king of Persia, Ahasuerus, but his wife has disrespected him in a very public way. And so then the advisors to the king advise him that she needs to be set aside, otherwise this will become a common thing for all wives in the kingdom to do to their husbands. And so he follows that advice, and the stage is set for the queen to be replaced. And so to pick up the story in chapter 2, verse 5, then, we find it says, in Shushan, the citadel, this is the capital city, there was a certain Jew whose name was Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, a Benjamite. So even though he's called a Jew, that was the title, if you will, of those in the southern kingdom. He was actually a Benjamite, so it was those of the tribe of Benjamin, those of the tribe of Judah, and then those scattered from Simeon and Levi that were in there as well. So we find here, we're introduced to Mordecai. And it says that Kish, that is Mordecai's father, had been carried away from Jerusalem to captives who had been captured with Jeconiah, king of Judah, whom Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, had carried away. In verse 7, and Mordecai had brought up Hadassah, that is Esther, his uncle's daughter. So they were cousins. So it seems that he was older because it says, when her father and mother died, Mordecai took her as his own daughter. Now, there could have been a big age difference. There could not have been a big age difference. We're not told. But he looked after her. He took care of her. In our terminology, he would have been her guardian. He would have overseen her protection and welfare. Verse 8, to continue here, it says, so it was when the king's command and the decree was heard, that is, that they were going to sort of collect all of these beautiful women, all these women of ability and so forth from around the kingdom, for the king to select from. When this king's decree was heard, when many young women were gathered at Shushan the citadel under the custody of Haggai, that Esther was taken to the king's palace into the care of Haggai, the custodian of the women. Now, the young women pleased him, and woman pleased him, rather, that is Esther, and she obtained favor in his sight, so he readily gave beauty preparations to her beside her allowance. And then 7 choice maidservants were provided for her from the king's palace, and he moved her and her maidservants to the best place in the house of the women. So already in this story, Esther has found favor. Could it have been her demeanor? Could it have been her beauty? Could it have been a combination of a number of things? But God here is sort of setting the stage for her, even if she's not aware of it. So in verse 10, it said, Esther had not revealed her people or her family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. That is, that she was a Jew. Now, maybe there was still a great deal of hatred towards the Jews in the kingdom. We'll find out later that Mordecai was aware of some of this. And maybe that was part of the reason why we're not told what his thinking was here, but he told her, don't reveal this just yet. So in verse 11, it says, every day Mordecai paced in front of the court as a worried father, sort of, because he couldn't go inside. That he was not allowed inside. And so now he's separated. He wants to know how she's doing. It says he paced in front of the court of the women's quarters to learn of Esther's welfare and what was happening to her. And it says each young woman's turn came to go into the king Ahasuerus after she had completed 12 months of preparation. Now, that's some beauty treatment, isn't it? 12 months they prepared before they saw the king. Maybe they were given lessons on etiquette, how to dress, how to behave, how to respond to the king, probably a number of things here. It says, thus were the days of the preparation apportioned, 6 months of oil of myrrh, 6 months with perfumes and preparation for beautifying the women. Thus prepared, each woman went to the king. She was given whatever she desired to take with her from the women's quarters to the king's palace. Jewelry, dress, shoes, whatever. This was all given to them, and they could choose. So it says, in the evening she went, in the morning she returned to the second house. This is Esther. To the house of the women, the custody of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch, who kept the concubine. She would not go to the king again unless the king delighted in her and called for her by name. So this selection process begins here, where initially they all went to the king, probably spent some time with him, conversations and whatnot, and he begins to narrow down his selection, if you will. Verse 15, now when the turn came for Esther, the daughter of Abial, the uncle of Mordecai, who had taken her as his daughter to go into the king, she requested nothing but what Haggai, the king's eunuch, the custodian of the women, advised. And Esther obtained favor in the sight of all who saw her. Perhaps she realized she didn't need all of this other stuff, whether it was jewelry or whether it was particular items, that she was confident enough, perhaps, in herself. And certainly, as it says here, she knew that she had favor. Probably a very gracious young lady. So as we continue then, in verse 16, Esther was taken to King Ahasuerus in his royal palace in the 10th month, which is the month Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. And if you go back to chapter 1 and you figure up all of the time period, 4 years have passed since Queen Vashti was removed to the time where we are now. Verse 21, to move down a little bit, in those days while Mordecai sat within the king's gate. Now, he was not of the king's core of advisors, if you will, but he seemed to have some preeminence in the city, at least, perhaps only from the Jews, maybe a wider circle. But he sat at the gate, which was typical of where the elders sat to make decisions, to hear pleas or to witness exchange of contracts or whatever. And it says here, two of the king's eunuchs, Bigthan and Teresh, doorkeepers, became furious and sought to lay hands on the king Ahasuerus. They decided they were going to help mount a coup. We're not told what they were angry about, but they were so angry they were willing to do this. And it says in verse 22, the matter became known to Mordecai, and Mordecai told Queen Esther. Esther informed the king in Mordecai's name. She told the king about the plot. She told how she knew of the plot, that Mordecai had found out about it. In verse 23, when an inquiry was made into the matter, it was confirmed. Both were hanged on the gallows, and it was written in the book of the Chronicles in the presence of the king. That is, the book of the Chronicles of the kings of Persia. This will become an important point here in a little bit. Verse 1 of chapter 3, then. After these things, King Ahasuerus promoted Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, and advanced him and set his seat above all the princes who were with him. So Haman, over the course of time, in whatever fashion, found favor with the king and was moved up, if you will, to be his number one advisor. And so verse 2, all the king's servants who were within the king's gates bowed and paid homage to Haman, for so the king had commanded concerning him. But Mordecai would not bow or pay homage. Now, this was the king's command. This is the king's right-hand man as well, that he told, the king told his subjects that you were to do this for Haman. So why would Mordecai refuse? Well, the simple answer up front is that Haman was an Agagite, as we're told. That is, a descendant of Amalek. And if you want to write in your notes, you can go back and read this later. Exodus 17, verses 8 to 16. Exodus 17, verses 8 to 16. When the children of Israel were coming out of Egypt, and you can imagine this long procession of the nation. I mean, when you're moving millions of people, you're going to have a long line of people. And at the end of the line, typically, were the people that moved slower. Those that were aged, those that had poor health, the young, typically the animals and so forth would be back there, the vulnerable. And Amalek, the Amalekites, attacked Israel from the rear. God did not look at this kindly. It was a coward's way of sort of sniping at a nation. So much so that God later told Israel, even after this account, before this account, God told Samuel to tell Saul that he was to wipe out the Amalekites. And if you remember that story, Saul did not. And the king Agag was standing before Saul, and Samuel came. Samuel inquired, Saul gave his excuses. And if you remember the story, Samuel killed Agag. So this is part of why Haman is not doing this here. Also factors into this the same situation that Daniel and his friends were in. He was not going to give that kind of respect to a human that was not their place. So, long and short of it is, then, verse 5, Haman saw that Mordecai did not bow or pay him homage. Haman became filled with wrath. How dare he not do this? Verse 6, but he, that is Haman, disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai, whether this was of the Jews or whether it was of the city or whether it was a wider audience. Mordecai himself had his own favor, if you will, with the people. And so rather than directly going after Mordecai, Haman decided to go roundabout. It says, instead, Haman sought to destroy all the Jews. Now that's some mindset, isn't it? That you get so angry at one individual for something done, perceived or real, and you're willing to kill a whole nation so that you can justify killing him. He sought to destroy all the Jews who were throughout the whole kingdom of Ahasuerus, the people of Mordecai. Haman is so angry at this, he's willing to do this act. He's willing to have the whole nation killed. And it shows how truly unbalanced and morally corrupt Haman was. So in verse 7 it says, in the first month, that is of God's calendar, because it says the month of Nisan, the 12th year of King Ahasuerus, they cast Pur, that is, Lot. And this comes into the story at the end of the book. This is where the festival of Purim comes from, that the Jews still celebrate to this day. It says, before Haman, that is, this lot came before Haman to determine the day and the month. So before Haman goes to the king, he draws this lot, and it tells him in his mind when this act should take place. And it says it fell in the 12th month, which is the month Adar. And so then verse 8, Haman said to King Azariah, so he goes to the king, "There is a certain people scattered and dispersed among the people of all the provinces of your kingdom. Their laws are different from all other peoples. They do not keep the king's laws," which is a lie. If they had not been keeping the law, the king would have dealt with it. What Haman is saying is, they don't keep your law first. "Therefore, it's not fitting for the king to let them remain. If it pleases the king, let a decree be written that they be destroyed. And I will pay 10,000 talents of silver into the hands of those who do the work to bring it into the king's treasuries." So Haman basically says, "I will put a bounty on their head. I will pay this into the king's treasuries if you let this be." Now, Haman must have been some man of wealth, 10,000 talents of silver. It's not a small sum of money. And so verse 10, "The king took his signet ring from his hand and gave it to Haman." This was a passing of authority, if you will, because with this signet ring, it gave the official stamp of the king to whatever proclamation. And this seems to have been something that he did permanently, that he gave Haman this right, if you will, to speak in his name. "So the king took the signet ring from his hand, gave it to Haman, the son of Hammedatha, the Agagite, the enemy of the Jews. And the king said to Haman, 'The money and the people are given to you to do with them as it seems good.'" So this whole scenario now is set up. And in verse 12, the scribes are called to write this all down. And in verse 13, all of these letters are sent out to all the provinces, giving authorization to any of the people, as it says in verse 13, to destroy, to kill, to annihilate all the Jews, both young and old, little children and women, in one day. Not only that, at the end of the verse, notice also to plunder their possessions, to be able to kill them and take their property. All of this to be done at the end of the year. Remember, it was the first month of the year, and all of this was to be done in the 12th month. So they had 11 months to sort of wait for this action. And as you can imagine, this is not a good spot for the Israelites to be in. Not just because of what's going to take place, but you've got 11 months now to worry about this, right? And know that in many cases, you have no recourse. So let's move down to chapter 4, verse 1. Mordecai learned all that had happened. He hears of this decree as it goes out throughout the empire. He tore his clothes. He put on sackcloth and ashes. He went out into the midst of the city and he cried with a loud and a bitter cry. This was his sort of act of civil disobedience here. He was not happy about it, and rightly so, but he was not going to hide his grief. He wanted others to know that he was very upset about this. Verse 2, "He went as far as the front of the king's gate, for no one might enter the king's gate clothed with sackcloth." That's a sign of mourning. It was not their right to go before the king and bring their troubles to him. Verse 3, "And in every province where the king's command and decree arrived, there was great mourning among the Jews with fasting, weeping and wailing, and many lay in sackcloth and ashes." So this is not just Mordecai, this is not just Esther concerned. All of the Jews are rightly concerned, and they approach God with fasting. Perhaps this is one of the fundamental things here that we'll come back to in a moment, of first and foremost, seeking God in a bad situation. Verse 4, Esther's in the king's palace. She's isolated from a lot of news in a lot of ways. And so it says that, her maids and eunuchs come and told her, and the queen was deeply distressed. So she sends garments to clothe Mordecai to take his sackcloth away, but he would not accept them. Then Esther called Hathach, one of the king's eunuchs, whom the king had appointed to her. She gave him a command concerning Mordecai to learn what and why this was. And Hathach went out to Mordecai in the city square and was in front of the king's gate. And Mordecai told him all that had happened, the sum of money Haman had promised to pay to the king's treasuries to destroy the Jews. He also gave him a copy of the written decree for their destruction, which was given in Shushan, that he might show it to Esther and explain it to her, that he might command her to go to the king and make supplication to him and plead before him for her people. Now, remember, she has not revealed to the king that she's a Jew. And if The king doesn't know, Haman doesn't know, and the court doesn't know, the inner court, if you will. He's reminding her here that she has an obligation. And this is where the courage begins to come in. Remember why Vashti was removed. Because she did not show respect to the king. In fact, she showed disrespect in a very public way. She did the opposite of perhaps what Esther is afraid of here. Esther is afraid of going having not been summoned. Vashti didn't go when she was summoned. And so perhaps she's very worried here. Verse 9, Hathach returned, told Esther the words of Mordecai. Then Esther spoke to Hathach and gave him a command. This is the back and forth, because Mordecai can't come into the palace. So there's this back and forth of sending messages. And this is Esther's message to Mordecai. All the king's servants and the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called, he has but one law, put all to death. If you presume to go before the king without being summoned, the king will have you put to death. So she's reminding Mordecai here, wait a minute, you're telling me to go before the king and he'll simply kill me. She says, except the one to whom the king holds out the golden scepter that he may live. That is, if the king sees them, finds favor with them, and invites them in. Yet I myself have not been called to go into the king these 30 days. So they told Mordecai Esther's words. So again, imagine the situation that she's in here. What is going through her mind? She knows her people have been given a death sentence. She probably sees what Mordecai is trying to remind her of. That this is only going to change directly from the king. If the original summons, or command rather, came from the king, then the only one that can change it is the king. But notice then what Mordecai reminds her of. Because we've all been in situations, not like this, but we've been in situations where we've been afraid. Human nature oftentimes will look for a reason why something cannot be done, especially in the face of fear. And this is, as I said, where courage comes in. Verse 12. So they told Mordecai Esther's words, and Mordecai told them to Esther, and this is what he said. Do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. In essence, once they find out you're a Jew, you're no more protected than the rest of us. For if you remain completely silent at this time, notice Mordecai's clarity here of trust in God. Relief and deliverance will arise for the Jews from another place. He had no doubt that God would deliver his people. He didn't necessarily know how. And if Esther wasn't going to do it, then it would come somewhere else. But also notice this. He says, if you don't do this, you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this? Oftentimes, it's hard for us to see or even consider that there might be a bigger picture that we're part of. We can become so focused on our little corner of the world, our little slice of life, that we may not see that there's something bigger going on. And I've reminded various members over the years of these sort of things. You know, why is God having me go through this trial? Well, maybe God's not having you go through the trial for you. Maybe the trial is for someone else, because God knows that you can take care of it. You can handle this. Maybe someone else can't, and you become the example. Maybe God does know that you can handle it, and he wants your example to be evident. Does God occasionally place his servants in a place and time for a greater purpose? Oh, absolutely. We have example after example in Scripture of these sort of things. We have the example of Joseph sold into slavery. Remember what he told his brothers when they finally found out who he was? You thought to do this for evil, but God purposed it for good. Not only did he save Egypt, but he saved Israel, didn't he? What about the examples of Moses? 40 years he received training in the house of Pharaoh. Some have speculated that perhaps he would have been in line to be the Pharaoh. Then he falls out of favor, he flees for his life, and he spends the next 40 years as a shepherd. That's quite a career shift, isn't it? But God was teaching him things there as well, because then for the next 40 years after that, God used him to lead Israel. All of his training in organization and planning and leading on a physical level, and all the years of learning how to work with sheep, who are some of the most unintelligent animals out there, who will do dumb things in spite of their own well-being. We have so many other examples. Gideon and Samson, Barak, Paul. Go read Hebrews 11 this week. Those are people that had to have courage. And it wasn't just courage that they screwed up, that God helped them to have this. But God doesn't use people. He's not using Esther here. He didn't use Moses in the sense of what we think or what we see in the world around us, of using people. God was selecting them to become part of something bigger than their own life. Mordecai, in this example, is showing Esther that she was to consider that God may have placed her in the royal family for the very specific reason so that the nation would be saved. And that courage was required. So how did Esther react? Verse 15. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise." She wasn't asking them to do something for her in place of her. She was asking them to do the same thing she was doing to support her. "And I will also go to the king then, which is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. Now, did you catch verse 17? Some roles shifted in there, didn't they? Who became the leader and who became the follower? See, this aspect of leadership transcends gender and age, position, and various things that we love to have on a human level. She fasted, which goes back to the earlier reference. She sought God's input to be humbled so that God would be able to work these things out through her, perhaps. Are we learning to be leaders? Leaders of courage, especially. What can we learn from her example? Because courage is not just stepping up to the plate because we have to. That's an obligation. That's not courage. It's not thinking that you alone can do the task, that no one else could possibly handle this. That's arrogance. Courage is doing something that no one else will do, something that needs to be done and no one else is doing it, as in the case of Esther here. Perhaps there were other things that could have been done, should have been done, but somebody had to step up, and that's what Mordecai is telling her here. Courage can also be doing what others are failing to do. So, what was Esther's plan? Well, she decided to host a dinner. She wanted the king to see the impact of this decree, what it would have. She knew that Haman was involved in it, and she wanted the king to see her humility in approaching him on behalf of her people. And courage is rarely a very comfortable thing. In fact, she didn't just invite him to one dinner. She invited him to two. And the first one, he asked her what she wanted, and she basically said, "Well, come back to dinner tomorrow night, and I'll tell you." But here is Esther, a queen, fully aware of what happened to her predecessor. She knows what will happen to her people if she does nothing. She knows, as I said, that Haman is behind this decree, and yet she can't go directly to Haman. Haman has the king's ear, if you will, has his signet ring. Esther's practicing not only physical courage here, her life literally is on the line, but she's also practicing moral courage, stepping out in faith here. Remember, physical courage is courage in the face of hardship or even death, and moral courage is acting right in face of opposition. Chapter 5 is this banquet. the first one. And then chapter 6 is sort of an inset chapter here. If you remember earlier, we were told that Mordecai exposed this plot to kill the king, and that deed was recorded in a book for the king. And then chapter 6, verse 1, we find that the king could not sleep. And I don't see this as just a happen chance thing. I see God directing this. Because the king couldn't sleep, he asked for this record, the chronicles, to be brought to him. And maybe he, I don't know, maybe he thought if he read a long list of things that had been taken care of that, you know, he would get bored and tired and he would go to sleep. But in any case, he read here, verse 2, of what Mordecai had told him concerning the plot of Bigthana and Teresh. And so verse 3, then he asked, well, what was done for this? And the answer was nothing. Nothing was done to honor Mordecai. And maybe the king began pondering here. He knew who Mordecai was. Mordecai was at the gate. Even if Mordecai didn't function within the official government, if you will, Mordecai had a presence in the community. His reputation was known as well. And so then as the king is pondering this stuff, Haman comes into the court. Why he was coming in the middle of the night, maybe it was morning by now. But anyway, he shows up. Again, I think God's hand is in this. I see it. In verse 6, then Haman comes in, the king asks him. Now, bear in mind here, the king is thinking one thing and Haman is thinking another. The king is thinking about Mordecai, that nothing was done to honor him for this huge favor, if you will, that he did for the king in exposing this plot. So this is going through the king's mind. Haman's thoughts are on himself. So Haman comes in, the king asks him, what shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? And notice Haman's response. He didn't say, who are you talking about, my lord? He says to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? He couldn't be talking about anybody else. So this is what Haman answers, thinking, what would I want? For the man whom the king delights to honor, let a royal robe be brought, which the king has worn. That is a direct symbolic gesture of being right there with the king. You can't get any closer than being king himself. And a horse on which the king has ridden, which has a royal crest placed on his head, let this robe and horse be delivered to the hand of one of the king's most noble princes, that he may array the man whom the king delights to honor. Then parade him on horseback through the city square and proclaim before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. And then the king said to Haman, I like that idea. Hurry, take a robe and a horse as you have suggested. And Haman's waiting for it. And then God twists the whole thing around. For so Mordecai the Jew who sits within the king's gate, leave nothing undone, all that I've spoken. Not only did this not happen for Haman, but Haman is the one that has to deliver these things. God does have a sense of humor. So Haman had no choice. He's the one that floated this idea. So verse 11, Haman took the robe, the horse, he arrayed Mordecai, he led him on horseback through the city square, proclaimed before him, thus it shall be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. And afterwards, Mordecai went back to the king's gate, but Haman hurried to his house, mourning with his head covered. He was not happy. This didn't play out the way he thought it would. Haman was so full of himself that he could not even imagine that the king would seek to honor someone else. The fact that Haman, as I said, was required personally to bestow this honor upon Mordecai was probably more than Mordecai could take. So he goes home and he cries to his family. So chapter 7, verse 2. This banquet is called Esther. At the end of chapter 6, Esther again asks for this banquet. And so then, verse 2 of chapter 7, on the second day at the banquet of the wine, the king again asked Esther, what is your petition, Queen Esther? It shall be granted to you, and what is your request? Up to half the kingdom. That's quite a magnanimous gesture, isn't it? Verse 3, then Esther answered and said, if I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. Had we been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy would have never compensated for the king's loss. She's asking the king to stop the petition. The king has to make the connection here and realize what she's saying is that she's a Jew. This is news to him now. But he's mad because he knows what this decree means. As we'll read here in a moment, it cannot be revoked. Verse 5, King Azarias answered and said to the Queen Esther, who is he and where is he? Who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing? So there's also an object lesson in here that if you're ever in a position to grant such things, you need to pay attention to what's being asked for. The king didn't pay close enough attention initially. And he evidently forgot who had floated this idea. Well, there's only three of them there. It's not the king. It's not the queen. So verse 6, Esther says, the adversary and the enemy is this wicked Haman. And he has no place to hide. Where is he going to go? So it says Haman was terrified. He knew what this meant. He sees the king's anger. He sees the favor that Esther has. And he knows that he's in a very, very difficult position here. But remember that the king, this is all new to the king. He's finding out that Esther is a Jew. He's realizing the implications of the decree that was given months earlier. He realizes now that his most trusted advisor has used him, worked an angle here. And so in verse 7, he's very angry. He arose in his wrath from the banquet of wine, and he went to the palace garden. He was so mad he couldn't even think straight. So he leaves. It's not a bad thing. Rather than do something in haste and anger, he went to collect his thoughts. And while he's gone, then it says, Haman stood before Queen Esther, pleading for his life, for he saw that evil was determined against him by the king. He could see the king was not happy. And that's never a good place to be. But Haman digs himself a deeper hole here. Before we get to that, let's think about how much courage did it take on Esther's part to present this. She didn't know how the king was going to react. She had an idea of what she hoped he would do. She didn't know what Haman would do, how he would respond. Remember, she had told Mordecai, if the king doesn't find favor, my life is forfeited. Think about what's going through the king's mind, as I mentioned. He evidently loved Esther deeply. She gave him respect. She gave him honor. The former queen did not. She pleased him in every way, and she was a blessing to him. What decision is he going to make? So he's left to think. And then in verse 7, after he left there, in verse 8, I'm sorry, then the king returned from the palace garden to the place of the banquet. Haman had fallen across the couch where Esther was. Now, he had probably done this, pleading for his life. But as the king returns, he sees Haman on top of his wife. And if he was angry before, he's very angry now. So the king says, will he also assault the queen while I'm in the house? And as the word left the king's mouth, they covered Haman's face. And he became a dead man walking. His life was over at that point. It was simply a matter of the time. And so then verse 9 and 10, he's hanged on the gallows that he had prepared. Very fitting, if you will. God has an interesting way of working these things out. In chapter 8 then, it says, on that day, King Azarias gave Queen Esther the house of Haman. This is, again, how upset the king was that he was betrayed. So he takes the possessions of that family. He gives them to his queen. And it says, Mordecai came before the king for Esther and told how he was related to her. Mordecai now comes forward and explains his relationship. The king didn't know any of this prior to this. But he begins to put things together in his head. The courage of Esther, her good character, the courage of Mordecai, his good character, remembering what Mordecai had done to save his life, probably recognizing his good standing within the community. And so in verse 2, Mordecai is elevated to the position that Haman had previously had. Mordecai essentially becomes the second in charge. It says here, he gave him his ring taken from Haman. See, Haman had that ring. He wore it as a representative of the king, could make whatever proclamation, if you will, in the king's name. He had that authority. That authority is now given to Mordecai. And it says, and Esther appointed Mordecai over the house of Haman because she owned it now. So she gave it to Mordecai to oversee all of his possessions. Remember, he was promising the king 10,000 talents of silver to kill these Jews. There's wealth in that family. That all now becomes Mordecai's. But Esther's not done. The situation hasn't been fully resolved, has it? She still has to ask the king. And so in verse 3, she spoke again to the king, fell down at his feet. She's beseeching him in a very humble way here. The courage it took. Because even though she saw the king's anger against Haman, she still doesn't know how he's going to handle this. And so she makes her petition, implored him with tears. That alone probably changed the situation. God gave women an unfair advantage. When they cry, it just ends everything. So she cries to the king here to counteract the evil of Haman, the scheme that he had devised. And so the king holds out the scepter. He finds favor. He grants her this audience, if you will. So Esther arose and stood before the king and said, if it pleases the king, if I had found favor in his sight, the thing that seems right to the king and I am pleasing in his eyes, let it be written to revoke the letters devised by Haman, which he wrote to annihilate the Jews who are in the king's provinces. For how can I endure to see the evil that will come to my people? Or how can I endure to see the destruction of my countrymen? At this point, her life probably would be spared. The king would not allow it. But that still leaves her countrymen exposed, doesn't it? So King Azarias, verse 7, said to Queen Esther and Mordecai the Jew, indeed, I have given Esther the house of Haman, and they have hanged him on the gallows because he tried to lay his hand on the Jews. You yourselves write a decree concerning the Jews as you please in the king's name and seal it with the king's signet ring. For whatever is written in the king's name and sealed with the king's signet ring, no one can revoke. What he is saying here is Persian law, once it was sealed, could not be revoked. So he says, I can't change the law, but you can amend it. And so here's what they amended. These scribes are called in verse 9 and 10, and it essentially says in verse 11, by these letters, the king permitted the Jews who were in every city to gather together to protect their lives, to destroy, kill, and annihilate all the forces of the people or provinces that would assault them. So essentially, they were given permission to fight back. And if they did so in killing these people, they could take their property. So you sort of set a situation up here of detente, don't you? To use an old 70s term. Okay, if you thought you had the upper hand and there was no chance of reciprocity here that they could fight back, then that's pretty enticing, isn't it? But now if you understand that they can fight back and if they kill you, they own your property, then I suspect a lot of people were saying, no, I'm good. We'll just let it be. But not everybody. So verse 13, these copies were sent out. Verse 14, the couriers took it to all of the lands of the kingdom. And so in verse 15, Mordecai goes out now with the royal apparel of the king, because now he's his advisor. So chapter 9. The 12th month comes along, the situation's at hand, what's going to happen? Verse 5, then it says, thus the Jews defeated all their enemies with the stroke of the sword, with slaughter and destruction, and did what they pleased with those who hated them. In Shushan, the citadel, the Jews killed and destroyed 500 men. And so then we also find in verse 10, the 10 sons of Haman, they were probably seeking retribution for the death of their father, thought maybe they could still see his plan implemented. So it says, verse 10, I'm sorry, the 10 sons of Haman, the enemy of Jews, they killed, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder. They didn't take their wealth. As you can imagine, there was great joy throughout the kingdom for the Jews. Their lives had been spared. And it says in verse 16, the remainder of the Jews in the king's provinces gathered together and protected their lives and had rest from their enemies. They killed 75,000 of their enemies, but they did not lay a hand on the plunder, even though under the king's law they could have. Now, that may not seem like much of a differentiation there, but they sort of took the high road. They protected themselves, but they didn't use it as an opportunity to increase their wealth. And so verse 17, this is where the celebration of Purim comes in. Purim. How does all of this relate to us? The story of Esther, how does it parallel to the calling that God has given us? You and I have individuals to instruct us as well. We might have parents, we could have pastors, we could have friends, colleagues. We also have God himself through his word. We've alluded to some of that, the examples of courage that many others have shown in living God's way of life. In all of those examples, in all of that instruction, we find that we're told to do. So our calling is not just an intellectual calling. It's not just a matter of having certain knowledge. It's a calling to do. And that doing is God's way of life, to put into action God's way of life. God shows us in the scripture, too, that true leaders are servants and they lead by example. We see that in Esther. She was not asking the people, well, I'll sit here in my comfortable little world. You guys go do all of these things. Now, she was there fasting as well. I never in my life have I fasted 3 days and three nights. But if I needed to, I would hope that I would have the same courage that Esther had. That's why we're taking a look at her life as one example. Her right action took character, that moral character that we talked about earlier, that knowing right from wrong and doing what is right. She knew that she needed to do these things for the sake of her people. You and I know that we have a destiny as well. We have a high calling. A calling and a destiny greater than before we understood it we could have ever dreamed of. Perhaps, to some degree, we even feel that we're not capable of reaching it. But remember the definition of courage, the ability and willingness to confront fear, pain, danger, uncertainty, or intimidation. See, God doesn't call us to be afraid. He calls us to have courage. How do we in God's church today react to this destiny? Do we look at this and embrace it, or do we say, who am I? How could I possibly have some special calling? Well, the fact of the matter is, we're God's children, as we heard in the sermonette. God doesn't view us as being limited. He sees so much potential in us. Many of the examples I referred to. Look at Noah in terms of the courage that he had. He used one man's family to preserve humanity and his creation. Preached for over 100 years. And if you read Genesis 6 at the beginning, it said that man's thought was evil continually. And yet he preached and served those people for more than 100 years, not seeing any change. When we're first called, becoming part of the God family may seem like fantasy. And in fact, to many outside of the Church of God, when we talk about being literally in the family of God, that's heresy to most people. But God gives us an opportunity not only to be in his family, but to lead, all of us. We can lead in our families, we can lead in our jobs, we can lead at various times, even when the body of Christ is gathered. Leadership takes all kinds of forms. But when one makes a firm commitment to living God's way of life, especially in this world, it takes courage. But it's courage that people notice. Because there are not a whole lot of people that are doing the right thing for the right reasons. In a time of crisis, people will notice others who stand out for those reasons. And they'll want to follow them. They'll want to follow their example, if nothing else. This is what's typified by Esther and many others. And it can be the same for you or me. Humanly, we can be full of doubts. Do you think Esther had her doubts? I do. It took two dinners. And those dinners were not, a couple of hour affairs. If you noticed in the one occasion, the one was 2 days long. How long was she putting this off? I understand that. There was a conversation she wasn't eager to jump into. I mentioned the faithful listed in Hebrews 11. Do you think they had their doubts? I know they did. Many of them are recorded. Look at Abraham. He had his doubts. God was going to bring him the heir through him and Sarah. So much so, he tried to work it out another way. But how does God settle our doubts? What does he want us to be focused on so that's not what drives us? Well, Philippians 4 and verse 13. God wants us to be assured, not only of our calling, but that he is a part of it. That it's not a matter of him calling us, and then the rest is up to us. We have to do our part, for sure. But it doesn't rest fully on our shoulders. If it was up to us completely, then we're doomed. We can't do this. We have too many flaws and weaknesses and shortcomings. In Philippians 4 and verse 13, Paul writes this, I can do all things through Christ. Look at a man like Paul. The letters that we have recorded, I have to surmise, maybe are only a fraction of what he did write. But look at the travels. By his own admission, the times he was shipwrecked, the times he was beaten, the times that he was in prison, does that take courage? I always have to laugh at the one example, and I'm blanking on the city right now, but he preached and the Jews stoned him and they thought he was dead. So they haul him out, they throw him on the trash heap outside the city. The fellow church members go out to mourn him and he revives. That's got to be spooky enough right there. And then he stands up and he collects himself and he goes back into the city. He wasn't done. That's courage. This is what he's talking about here. I can do all things through Christ. If it's up to us, we're going to get tired. We may get distracted. We may start to think it's all about us, like Haman. But if we remember that it's through Christ, then it says we can be strengthened. Let's go back to verse 6. Philippians 4, verse 6. Be anxious for nothing. And I have to admit, I'm still working on that one. Because life is uncertain, isn't it? Bad things happen. Situations come along out of our control. But it says, in everything, by prayer and supplication. This means not just passive waiting, but that we're beseeching God, we're staying close to him, we're doing the things that we need to do. And it says, with thanksgiving, let your requests be known to God. Because he can take care of these things. Hebrews chapter 4. Hebrews 4 and verse 14. Seeing then that we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. That takes courage. I mean, we could share our stories. How many people have lost jobs repeatedly over the Sabbath and holy days? How many people have lost family, children that have died too young, or family members that have passed quickly? Other trials in life. holding on in the face of adversity is part of that courage, isn't it? Verse 15, for we do not have a high priest who cannot sympathize with our weaknesses. And this is one of the things that I truly love about God's way of life. Esther showed us this in her example as well. God does not ask us to do things he has not done himself. Christ came and he lived the example. He didn't come just to die for our sins. That alone is huge. I'm not minimizing that by any stretch of the imagination. But the fact that he lived to be an example, he showed us it can be done. He understands our shortcomings, our weaknesses, because he was flesh. Yes, he lived a perfect life, but I don't think we appreciate the effort and the energy and the absolute necessity it took of staying close to God to do that. Not one day could he slip. And because he knows us better, probably, than we know ourselves, verse 16, let us therefore come boldly. He has given us the privilege of being able to come before his very throne, it says, the throne of grace, that we may obtain mercy and find grace to help in time of need. Did Esther need that help? Mordecai, the rest of the Jews at that time? You bet. Do we need that help any less now? We certainly do. All of this also serves to be a reminder that when we're in doubt how to proceed in a difficult situation, we need to go to God. We need to trust in him. We need to make sure that we're doing the right things before him so that he can and will intercede, as it says here, to help in time of need. But we should also be confident to know that he does hear us. He does care for us, and be confident that he wants us to develop and grow in his faith. So I'll conclude today by reading second memory scripture in Ephesians 6:10. At camp, during these days when these lessons are taught, there's at least one memory scripture that is given. On this day at camp, there were two. The first was Ephesians 4:13. The second is, it was Philippians 4:13. The second is Ephesians 6, verse 10. And it simply says this, finally, my brethren, be strong in the Lord and in the power of his might. Have courage. May we always have the courage to take on God's character and to be the examples of his way of life that this world so desperately needs.